charity. Ben prayed. We thank you for opening heaven to those created of the devil's hellfire and evil. May you purge our lives of temptations so we may reflect your pillars. Praise the pious God.
Praise the pious God,
echoed everyone on deck, save for the raiders.
You have been detained by the inquisitors of His Majesty's Church of Argrid,
Ben continued, addressing the raiders now.
Unholy items have been found in your possession. If you do not repent, the church will purify Argrid of your irredeemable soul.
The church had written this speech so detainees would have fair opportunities to repent. Everyone caught with plants was guilty, and admitting it was the only thing that could save their souls. They would still be rehabilitated for a time, but they wouldn't burn. Fair had had a different meaning under Ben's uncle. Back then, the accused were assumed innocent until the inquisitors passed a sentence based on careful analysis of church doctrine. Were their sins rooted in magic? If so, did they have evil plants that had been proven dangerous, or did they have pure magic used for healing or growth? But Rodrigo's betrayal had destroyed the luxury of assuming people were innocent. After his death, the church had disbanded the remaining inquisitors, and those who resisted had been burned as well. The only duty of the inquisitors that the church hadn't eliminated was searching inbound ships, but they had bastardized even that duty by giving it to careless aristocrats.
I won't repent for made-up sins, the captain spoke again. My crew and I are as innocent as you are, especially with that group from Argrid and Grace Lorraine right now. You want to condemn us for stuff your own men are negotiating.
Quiet,
a defensor snapped.
You're speaking to the Crown Prince.
Ben bit his tongue. You're right, he wanted to tell the captain. The church still ordered the arrest of anyone carrying Grace Lorraine's botanical magic, even when a contingent of Argridian diplomats was negotiating a peace treaty with the island's ruling council. When Ben's uncle and cousin had tried to change the church's stance on magic, Ben had watched them die. Anyone who supported the war had been exterminated as well. Ben didn't have much hope that a new treaty would change Argrid. Another of the raiders dared to chuckle.
The prince. You ain't as good-looking as they say, but maybe if you were the one kneeling.
Yakis punched the man so hard he flipped into the raider beside him. The movement caused a distraction, and just as Ben registered that, the mecht raider did too. The mecht flew up and slammed his body into Ben. Though his wrists were lashed to his back, that didn't affect the strength of the man's muscles or his eye of the sun. Ben careened toward the ship's railing, the mecht shoving with every bit of anger he had repressed as he knelt. The mecht's face was so close that when he breathed, heat brushed Ben's forehead, his senses flaring with ash and flame. Memories ruptured in Ben's mind, his uncle and cousin writhing on pyres. Screams. Panic overtook him. His spine connected with the railing, and the mecht exhaled a stream of fire that Ben dodged instinctively. He jerked to the left, the flames biting over his shoulder, and the mecht stepped back in surprise. Ben regained enough control to plant his feet and jam his elbow into the mecht's stomach. The fire cut off as the man let out a strangled cough.
Bring the barbarian down,
a defensor shouted.
Hold,
Ben countered. He flung himself up to sit on the railing while hooking his leg behind the mecht's knees. The mecht buckled, thrown off balance, and as he dropped, Ben rammed his other leg into the man's stomach. This laid him out across the deck, with the defensors training a dozen different weapons on him. Ben eased off the railing.
This is the evil forcing him to lash out, he barked. This man will still have the opportunity to repent along with the rest of you. I beseech you all, see through the devil's corruption in your hearts, repent and choose freedom. Otherwise, you will burn.
Had Ben saved the raider now only to have him die in front of a jeering crowd later? Though he didn't care, if raiders wanted to burn, let them burn. Argrid offered a way to survive if those convicted weren't so proud. Three defensors dragged the mech away as others moved toward the rest of the crew. Ben tugged his hat lower, the deck spinning. Yakis bumped his shoulder.
This will please your father.
Why?
Ben honestly wanted an answer.
I did nothing. Ever since the church did away with any real due process of justice, I have no use.
Yakis's eyes widened.
You're going to be king someday.
Of a country built on ashes and fear,
I don't believe magic is evil, and I miss it.
He'd never be drunk enough to say that, especially not to Yakis.
A low hum came from Yakis, the lilt of a church hymn. A tick of his. When he was nervous or anxious or thinking too hard about responsibilities that should have been Ben's alone.
If the treaty with Grace Luray happens,
Yakis said,
we won't arrest every sailor from there. Evil won't be as easy to identify. They'll need inquisitors to judge cases again.
Ben sighed.
Wishful thinking, Defensor.
The church had ultimate power now. Any treaty with Grace Luray would mean more of this, only on their shores. Patrols, purity, cleansing. Did Grace Luray know what was coming for them?
3. The stables provided the quickest route to the infirmary's shaking sickness wing. Lou hurried down the aisle, stirring up dust as she passed drowsy horses, flicking their tails in the heat. A little boy plunged down in front of her, hanging by his knees from a rafter.
Give me your plants!
Lou screeched and dropped the parcel in her arms.
Oh, Lou,
Teo said.
You're not the nurse.
Her surprise eased into a laugh.
And I have no magic plants for you to steal.
She bent to salvage the treat she had picked up on her way here. The filling in one of the pastries had leaked, making the parchment wrappings sticky, the air overly saccharine with sugary coconut against the sweet smell of straw.
Yet you are quite fearsome. Tell me, Raider, who are you?
Though she knew, Annalisa's brother always chose to be the same raider no matter the game.
He isn't the first boy I've encountered today who's pretending to be Devereaux Bell, Lou thought.
Teo swung up, grabbed the beam, and plummeted to the ground, surprisingly nimble for a 6-year-old boy.
I'm Devereaux Bell,
he confirmed, closing one brown eye and stabbing his fist into the air.
Uncatchable, undefeated, so scary I don't need any syndicate to protect me.
Among other things, Lou added, but she smiled at his delight. As I said, Mr. Bell, I am but a simple lady. May I interest you in a treat instead? Teo dove to his knees, leaning over the two small pastries she managed to recover.
Lou, he sang, can I have one?
Yes.
Anna gets the other one?
Anna gets the other one. He moped.
But you don't get any.
Lou passed him the largest pastry.
I already had one, T,
but you're sweet to worry.
Teo Casales! Oh, there you are!
The nurse he had been playing with appeared at the stable's door. Her smile struggled to hide her fatigue, brought on from too long tending Grace Luray's needy. When Annalisa fell too ill to care for herself, she had insisted on staying at the infirmary where she had volunteered, the one that served the impoverished of New Deza.
If I have good days, I can lend a hand,
she'd said.
If it gives you hope, Lou had thought, then anything.
Lou brought treats!
Teo leaped up to show the nurse. Lou rose and smoothed the hair away from his face, freeing the black strands that stuck to his cheeks as he chomped a mouthful of the chocolate-covered pastry. Whether his skin's red undertones were from childish exertion or an Argridian heritage was almost difficult to tell. Almost.
Why don't you go out to the garden? Lou told him. I'm sure they could use help.
The nurse nodded when Lou looked up for encouragement. Teo's eyes widened.
Maybe we'll find magic plants. I know they're only in rivers, but maybe, you never know.
Lou smiled. Garden plants had their uses, but didn't offer the guaranteed and unnatural effects of Grace Lorraine's magic. And even if the infirmary could grow healing magic plants, none had any effect on shaking sickness. Lou had spent enough time looking.
Maybe, she told him. The gardeners will appreciate your help regardless.
Teo took off but slammed to a halt and looked back.
Thank you for the treat,
he called and resumed running, the pastry clutched in both hands. The nurse's expression tightened.
Have you brought more treatments today?
Lou's lips straightened.
Soon.
She wouldn't be able to create the sleeping concoction with the ingredients from the market for a few days.
What's the count?
As if Lou might have forgotten how long Annalisa had been in the hospital. But she always hoped she miscalculated.
12 days, miss.
The nurse bit her bottom lip.
We lost another this morning. A man who had been here for...
She wrung her hands.
10 days.
Shaking sickness was as mysterious as Grace Lorraine's magic. No treatments, magical or otherwise, affected it. It didn't spread from person to person. Some patients suffered with it for years, others were taken in days. The only predictable thing about it was that it manifested in tremors at first, which eventually deteriorated a person's bones until they could no longer stand or walk on their own, confining them to an infirmary bed. Once that happened, it was a matter of days before the disease claimed its victim. Annalisa had gone into the hospital 12 days ago. The nurse pushed her wrists together, fingers cupped upward. Lou recognized the motion as one used by followers of Argrid's church. Her nose curled. How people could still believe in the church on Grace Lorraine after everything that toxic religion had done here was beyond Lou.
I pray for the Casales children,
the nurse said, speaking of Annalisa and Teo.
And for your soul as well.
Pray all you like, Lou wanted to tell her. Your God would never accept my soul.
Thank you,
Lou said through gritted teeth. She moved past with the remaining pastry. Annalisa would tell her to give it to Teo, but it would make her happy for a moment. Moments were all they had now. The war had seemed like a fun game at first, taking school lessons in the lower decks of steamboats and sleeping in blanket-filled cellars, always on the move, waking up in new places and around new people. But the illusion came to a crashing end when Lou was whisked out of a cellar one morning, her mother, Kari, screaming orders to their soldiers, with Tom grasping Lou's hands and yanking her around sprays of cannon debris. Lou learned that when Tom sang her to sleep at night, it was not always to comfort her. It was to cover the moaning of their soldiers upstairs as others dug bullets out of their limbs. And when people called her mother Kari the Wave, it was not because she so loved the ocean, as she told Lou. It was because she had single-handedly led dozens of armed rebels into an Argridian headquarters to steal their battle plans, sunk a fleet of enemy steamboats, rescued prisoners from a damp mission basement, and performed dozens of other acts that kept the rebels afloat. None of this was a game. The war was a necessity, and as Lou got older, she became a part of that necessity, more than the other children of the rebels. Like Annalisa, they believed in the fun of revolution long after she had learned the truth.
It'll end soon, Annalisa had often declared. My mother promised.
My parents have never promised me that, Lou thought. But she would smile and play with the other children and use their innocence as fuel when her parents sent her on missions. But she was with Annalisa for the war's end. Lou tried not to remember the day for many reasons. It served as a definitive break. Before that day lay the war and her duty as a soldier. After it, peace,
and her duty to help her parents build a functioning country. There was no place in her new reality for the children she had grown up alongside. Only months after the revolution's end did Lou's mother ask,
"Why have you not seen Annalisa? You two were once friendly."
Looking at Annalisa was like reliving the sacrifices of the war. Lou had been glad to have other children to motivate her during it, but it was finished. Annalisa had escaped unscathed. What more could there be? Sickness, apparently. After Annalisa and Teo's mother, Bianca, died of shaking sickness, and Annalisa came down with the same illness, Lou had stumbled back into her life. She had kept a war from hurting Annalisa. She would not let something as small and useless as a disease harm her. Or so she had tried, and still tried. Now Lou reached Annalisa's wing. The peeling plaster walls surrounded a dozen patients in cots, most of Mecht ancestries thanks to New Diza's position in the declared territory of the Mecht Syndicate. Only the impoverished hospitals needed entire wings dedicated to shaking sickness. It struck mostly the poor. However shaking sickness happened, Annalisa had probably gotten it, like Bianca, from helping those who refused to help themselves. This was Annalisa's reward for being more selfless than Lou could hope to ever be. A death sentence. Annalisa's dark eyes dropped to the pastry as Lou approached.
"You smuggled that past Teo?"
Lou sat next to her, nodding her petticoat and shift around her legs to block bedbugs from making a meal of her. She ignored the stench of the foul bedding, the muffled screams from the surgery wing, and the occasional retching of other patients.
"He insisted you have it," Lou said. "A generous little boy, that one."
Annalisa picked up the pastry. Her arm's splint reached only to her wrist, leaving her hand free. A few bruises decorated her fingers, but Lou forced herself to overlook them.
"Have they finalized the treaty yet?"
Annalisa asked. Lou bit down on her lip. The council was weeks from approving the treaty, according to Lou's mother. The war might have technically ended 5 years ago, but this would ensure it was truly, finally over. Lou fought the unease that had been filling her since the Argridian diplomats had landed. She didn't want to think of them. She yanked open Botanical Wonders, the cover creaking as much as the cot. The descriptions from Grace Luray's earliest explorers stared up at her, along with her own scribblings, and she dove into the distraction.
"Where did we leave off last time? The digestive plant?"
Annalisa hesitated, her finger coated in the pastry's rum glaze. Her eyes widened and her face broke out with sweat. Violent tremors clacked her teeth, and she dropped the pastry, a shaking spell rushing over her, limbs twitching so she looked as though she was trying to fly. When it passed, Annalisa pressed her forehead to Lou's arm, tangles of black hair falling around her face. The patients in the other cots didn't glance over, so it wasn't shame that made Annalisa turn away. It could have been pain, though her body occasionally released tremors, her internal organs were in a constant state of convulsion. That was part of why she was covered in blankets despite the heat. She didn't want Teo seeing the yellow and blue marks on her limbs.
"Digestive," Lou tried again. "Purple stems with magenta leaves, found in the peat bogs of Backswamp. Consuming one stem sates hunger for 7 days. Based on that," Lou forced a smile, "when would be the most inopportune moment to take it?"
Annalisa lifted her head. A vein in her eye had burst, streaking red around her dark iris.
"Will you never give up?" she asked.
Bianca had fled from Argrid when Annalisa was 10, and painful fits let the accent Annalisa had grown up with sneak through.
"I fought in the revolution to keep people like you happy," Lou thought. "If I can ease this suffering of yours now, somehow, some way. No, Annalisa, I will not give up."
"Digestive," Lou nudged her, emphasis heavy on the word.
"Fine, fine."
Annalisa let her head fall back against the wall, her dark hair sliding off her neck.
Digestive. If it sates hunger for days, then the most inopportune moment to take it would be the day before the mild season festival. Think of all that food you'd be unable to eat. Roasted aubergine and pigtail stew. And, oh, the smoked fish, it would be torment.
Then we'd best get some for Tao before the next festival. Remember last year? He ate fistfuls of that imported whipped sugar and vomited all over the Emerdian trader's booth. You had to buy 2 dozen stone rings and a whole stack of Emerdian leather hats because he ruined them.
Annalisa's grin froze.
Lu,
she said. Lu's hands tightened around botanical wonders, her finger finding its way to the bullet hole in the back cover.
You've done so much already. But you'll take care of him, Tao, I mean.
It won't come to that.
I'm all he has. When I need to know he'll be cared for.
She took a breath. It did little to steady her voice.
His Argridian heritage is as undeniable as mine. If he ends up on the streets, a child his age with obvious enemy blood, even if the council signs a treaty, prejudices like that don't die. He'll be...
Stop. Lu laid a hand on her arm. He isn't Argridian, and neither are you. You're Grace Lorraine. You'll be cared for, and so will he, and you don't need to worry about such things. Annalisa's smile matched her bloodshot eyes.
The island is so simple from your view.
Why shouldn't it be? Lu's tone was harsher than she'd intended, but words spilled out from behind her unease. Why shouldn't we be one country working toward the same goal? Why shouldn't we put our past ills behind us? If everyone agreed to live by the laws of this new country, we would have a fresh start. We could stop fearing people with Argridian blood, or assuming those who look Mecht or Tunkian or Grosden are raiders, because we would all be Grace Lorraine. We wouldn't even need a treaty to ensure that Argrid wouldn't attack us again. We would be so strong in our unity that they could never hurt us. Lu stopped, gasping. Annalisa put a hand on Lu's where she gripped botanical wonders. The book mocked her now, that she thought a game could distract from the meeting that awaited her.
Lu,
Annalisa started, voice cautious.
Are you?
Anna!
Teo's squeal made the inhabitants of the wings stir. He hurried down the aisle, his black locks once again sticking to his sweaty face, proof he had been out toiling under the sun.
Anna,
he whispered when he got to the foot of her bed, remembering her rule in the infirmary. Soft voices.
Did Lu give you the pastry? Isn't it delicious?
Annalisa grinned.
So delicious, T. I doubt I can finish it. Help me?
He crawled up onto the bed, squishing in on her other side, his hands leaving streaks of chocolate syrup on the already stained bedding. His eyes brightened when he saw the book on Lu's lap.
Lu, you brought the magic book,
he cried, and patience groaned at the volume. Lu grinned and passed it to him. You'll be better at this game than I am one day.
I'm good at every game.
Oh, are you?
Annalisa nudged him.
Prove it, little man.
Footsteps thudded toward them on the warped floorboards. Lu rose, expecting nurses rushing to attend a patient, but a lone nurse slid to a stop at the foot of Annalisa's bed.
Miss Andrew,
she gasped.
A runner brought a note for you, but news is already spreading. They've caught him. He's being held at the castle.
Caught who?
Tao asked. Lu took the proffered note as the nurse smiled at him.
A stream raider. But not any stream raider. One who isn't with a syndicate. It's...
Disbelief squeezed Lu's throat, making her voice high as she read the name in her mother's note.
Devereaux Bell.
4. Nudisa's castle provided the best view in Grace Lorraine.
Argrid had built it decades ago, high on one of the ebony cliffs that jutted over Lake Regolith. The port spread out beneath it like a sand deposit, cut apart by narrow rivers that infused the air with gray plumes of steamboat fog. Beyond, the view dissolved into the crisscrossing waterways that split Grace Luray into a bedlam of soggy swamps, dense jungle, and ramshackle ports, capped by the dormant volcanic mountains in the northern distance. Normally, the enchanting view would immobilize Lu, but today she found her anxiety too potent to be cleansed by beauty, and she stopped on the highest of the stone steps that led to the castle's doors, clenching and unclenching her fists. Beyond these doors, the Argridian negotiation awaited, and now, the fate of Devereaux Bell. Suspicion tasted sour on her tongue. But no, it was a coincidence that her pickpocket had resembled Devereaux Bell. The most notorious stream raider on Grace Luray certainly would not have failed to rob her, nor was he so young, and surely it was not him. On that brittle yet resolute thought, Lu opened the castle doors. Lu's memories of the months following the revolution were patchy, filled with the haze of relief and joy and the chaos of victory. But a few events had seared into her brain. Playing with a little dog in a free and safe new Diza market. Tom fixing her hot chocolate, the decadence of the treat making her want to weep. And walking with her parents and other revolutionaries through this castle entryway with the surrendered Argridians. The castle's empty entrance hall fanned out with glittering windows on either side of the door, the domed ceiling and marble floor accented by sea-glass chandeliers and gold conch shells. Towering white and gold doors marked the courtroom, well-oiled so they did not give Lu away as she slipped into the ongoing meeting. The long room's newly polished black-and-white tiles glinted in the light of the chandeliers. Pillars framed two sections of wooden pews, facing a dais with a table and chairs for the senior council members, the four people who oversaw voting and motions of the 24 general council members seated in the pews. One of the seniors, Laszlo Spitz, flipped to a fresh page in his ledger.
"Motion passed," he declared, and made a note.
The attendees showed little reaction, so the bill must not have been controversial. General council members and other politicians took up the first several pews, while the rest were open to the public. Lu knew most of the members the same way she knew Annalisa and Bianca, from back when they had all been rebels. In the first row were five people who had fought under Kari at the ambush of an Argridian storehouse on the coast. Off to the left sat two women who had snuck into a church mission with her mother and freed 24 captive rebels. Now the women were stoic in linen jackets and airy petticoats, the men in brass-buttoned coats and tricorn hats, all with brown skin and dark features. No one would have guessed that they had once been insurgents. The Argridian delegates, at the front of the room, were focused on the seniors. Lu purposefully ignored them and the hum of discomfort that came at their presence. Enemies, instinct told her. Years of being taught to fear and fight them could not be quelled. Lu slipped into one pew and sat, exhausted, next to her father. Tom smiled. The Argridian red tone of his skin gave him a permanent warmth in his expression, always close to smiling or winking at her.
"We didn't mean to pull you away from Annalisa," he whispered. "I know you only recently rekindled your friendship with her. Madness that two people can survive a revolution, yet an illness can strike them down within 2 years of each other."
"Bianca may be dead, but Annalisa is still alive," Lu wanted to say. "I don't mind," she lied. But which location would be less miserable? The infirmary, watching her friend suffer? Or here, a stone's throw from Argridian diplomats who had slaughtered people on her island? Especially not for the arrest of an unaligned stream raider. What do we know?
"Bell was in the dungeon with common criminals, and other raiders betrayed his identity."
"What of his crew?" Tom shook his head and opened his mouth to say more as Laszlo banged his gavel.
Like everyone around her, Lou sat up straighter. She had proven herself during the revolution by catching details from enemies, as those with something to hide often lowered their guard around children. Her parents relied on her now for the same reason. With her mother as a senior council member and her father as a general council member, they trusted her to hear what might otherwise go unnoticed by officials.
"The next item deviates from our negotiations,"
Laszlo said.
"But if our guests allow, we will sentence a convicted criminal and return to proceedings within the hour."
Lou's mother spun on Laszlo.
"The accused has not yet been convicted. We have not even interrogated him," Kari stated.
"What would be the point?"
Laszlo consulted his ledger.
"Devereaux Bell is the suspect in more than 36 counts of theft from Grace Larray. Witnesses say he stole variegated holly from the castle's own stockpiles. He was also seen taking 2 boatloads of hemlite and the vessels as well. He has impersonated members of the council. I could go on. The syndicates at least hold to a certain level of honor and do not steal from under our watch. An unaligned raider like Devereaux Bell deserves no sympathy. We must condemn him immediately and return to the far more pressing matter of the treaty."
"Bell deserves to be aware of the reason for his sentence," Kari countered. "Our Argridian guests do not expect this country to cease proper procedures for them."
One of the Argridian diplomats rose from the front pew. No, not one of them. The only one who mattered. Milo Ibarra, a favorite general of the Argridian king. Lou's body went stiff. When Argrid had stopped calling Grace Larray a colony and started calling it an abomination, Milo had overseen its cleansing. Now here he was, a human embodiment of the war, returned under a banner of peace.
"Of course not, Mrs. Andrew," said Milo, straightening his silken overcoat. "We are most eager to bear witness to how Grace Larray handles stream raiders, in fact."
Kari's brow furrowed.
"Handles?"
"Once we finalize this treaty, threats to Grace Larray become threats to Argrid. It is no secret that raiders are a danger."
Milo took a step forward, hands behind his back. The chandeliers flared light on his greased black hair, the steep Argridian slants of his jaw and nose.
"The raiders deal in the most dangerous botanical magic and spread such hazards to their corresponding mainland countries. All botanical magic trade with the mainland is now tightly controlled," said Laszlo, shifting in his chair. "The council has binding trade agreements with Tunke's Empress, Emerdin's Queen, and 15 of the 20 Mechlin clan lords. And after this treaty is finalized, we will be proud to add Argrid to that list as well."
Milo's expression was sardonic. The Argridian treaty had not yet touched on what magic, if any, would be approved for legal sale in Argrid.
"Treaties between governments will not stop criminals, Senior,"
Milo responded.
"The Stream Raiders' threats extend beyond magic trade. They encourage disunity by holding to their countries of origin, Emerdin, Tunke, the Mechlins, and Grozda, and funneling impoverished immigrants between nations, which spreads diseases due to their destitution and unsanitary lifestyles. I understand you have tolerated them because of an ill-made promise during the war, but promises should not excuse crimes."
Those around Lou shifted awkwardly, shame pinking their cheeks for the pestilence of stream raiders. But Lou was overcome with rage at Milo for ignoring why they had made a promise to the raiders at all.
"If you mean to change a way of life, you must offer a benefit the old way could not," Lou's mother had said. "Something more valuable, or that would solve a more immediate problem."
Over the course of the 8-year war, Kari and the other leaders had tried numerous times to get the raiders to join forces with them. Neither Argrid nor the rebels had numbers on their side. Argrid because they were used to enacting obedience through the threat of damnation, and the rebels because they were only made up of those rare people willing to risk their lives for freedom. But toward the end, Argrid overtook a rebel headquarters. The revolution leaders, finding their safe house and the assets therein compromised, grew desperate. They didn't have the numbers to retake the safe house from the majority of Argrid's forces. And so Kari and a handful of revolutionaries told the Stream Raiders that if they helped end the war, they would have a place in the new government. The Raiders, eager to have unmatched control over Grace Luray, agreed. Despite months of negotiations after the war, the Raider syndicates scoffed at the proposed system of laws, demanded anarchy, and retreated to their declared territories when they did not get their way. Unity with the Raiders should have happened. Without laws keeping them in check, they were what Milo said, a constant source of danger and threat, a drain on the economy.
That promise was not ill-made, Lou's mother said.
Lou smiled. Trust Kari to always advocate for Grace Luray's best interests.
The Raiders' support allowed peace to come between Grace Luray and Argrid. Their existence speaks to cultural differences we should embrace, and we will treat Raiders, including Devereaux Bell, as the worthy citizens they are.
Milo scoffed.
The only thing criminals like Devereaux Bell are worthy of is death, Mrs. Andrew. I have been under the impression that you wanted us to see Grace Luray as a functioning nation, not as an embarrassment.
Lou's hands fisted around the strap of her satchel, her mind echoing with a childlike plea.
Leave. Please leave. Get off my island. Leave us in peace.
Kari's golden brown skin paled, the only sign of her displeasure, and she didn't engage Milo further. The rest of the seniors remained silent, whether in fear or shame, Lou wasn't sure. A moment, and Kari waved to a soldier standing by a door behind the dais.
Bring in Bell,
she said in the voice that reminded everyone of her moniker during the revolution, the Wave. She could break with unstoppable fervor and be completely unmoved, no matter the opposition. The mood of the courtroom changed. People rose, angling to see the doorway. Lou couldn't help but think of Teo, how he would have reacted to Devereaux's entrance with the same desperate curiosity. The soldier opened the door. Another entered, blocking the man behind him, trailed by a final soldier. Two more followed, which felt extreme for the guarding of one man, chained at the wrists and ankles with irons that rattled. But Devereaux Bell's notoriety made them cautious. The men stopped in front of the seniors, the soldiers blocking Devereaux from view of the room. A waist-high beam with an iron loop at the top had been set into the floor before the dais. One soldier linked Devereaux's wrist manacle to the post, and the soldiers stepped to the side. Devereaux Bell, his back to the room, stood like a man well aware of the power he wielded, leaning his weight casually on one leg. He was wiry but tall, and his dress was what one would expect of a raider. Threadbare pants, knee-high boots, his shirt sleeves rolled to the elbows in varying shades of black and speckled with patches and stains. Unlike most men, he did not wear his hair tied back. The black strands hung loose to his shoulders. Collecting botanical magic from Grace Luray was not without its dangers. Most plants grew deep in the riverbeds, and only explosives could dislodge the rarest specimens. This resulted in wounds like the one Devereaux was known for, his missing right eye. He pivoted his head to the left, a glance over his shoulder, but all Lou could see were the muscles in his jaw. Was he smiling? He looked straight ahead again. Kari gaped. Even Laszlo looked flustered, his eyes shooting once to Milo, who stood close enough that he could make his voice heard should he wish to weigh in. Lou realized how hazardous this trial would be. Milo would be satisfied only if the council proved its authority over raiders by condemning Devereaux Bell to death, a sentence the council had not yet passed on anyone. What would it mean to the council's tentative peace with the syndicates if their first death sentence was a raider? But would it come to that?
Devereaux Bell,
Laszlo began.
Vex, Devereaux countered.
Laszlo gave a look that said he was not, despite how appropriate it might be, going to call the raider Vex. Lou shifted. Exhaustion from so many stresses in one day made her falter. She steadied herself on her father's arm. Tom gave her a questioning look, but she shook her head.
You are the suspected perpetrator of 42 counts of piracy against the Grace Lorraine Republic, ranging from black market trades to theft,
Laszlo began.
How do you plead?
Devereaux snorted.
Only 42 official counts? Damn, I just lost a bet.
Lou's grip on her father's arm tightened. That voice, the flippancy. It was Kari who asked.
Only 42. How many should we have on record?
That's a loaded question. Might as well ask how long I want to be imprisoned. Though, if it means getting to see such a fine specimen again, I might confess everything.
Laszlo banged his fist on the table.
How dare you speak so about a woman of such esteem? Presumptuous, sir. I meant you.
Devereaux made a crude gesture with his arm and fist. Kari dipped her head while the rest of the seniors dissolved into outrage. Laszlo jabbed a finger at Devereaux but said nothing. His jowls swung, but again, he said nothing. Spit flew, and still he could not think of a retort to the raider's insinuation. Lou's exhaustion crept over her in a horrifyingly unexpected way. An effervescent sensation started in her belly, and before she could gather her wits enough to reason that it was not funny, seeing Laszlo so flustered, she laughed. All attention swung to her, four rows from the front with her hands over her mouth. Devereaux turned at long last, searching the crowd for the laughter. He didn't find her straight away, allowing Lou time to study him, and her suspicions were confirmed. Devereaux Bell had tried, and failed, to pick her pocket that morning. She knew now what had troubled the seniors, the crimes Devereaux had committed, the way he had spent the past year escaping justice. Everyone had expected to find a weathered outlaw. But this man couldn't have been older than 20. Kari put her hand on Laszlo's arm to pull his attention away from Devereaux, and Lou now. The motion woke Lou out of her trance, and the weight of her actions settled on her. The seniors regrouped around her mother. The rest of the room expressed their disdain for Lou's outburst with snide expressions, none more so than Milo. Lou willed herself to look at him. His scowl mirrored those around him, but it held disgust. To him, she was a lady who had breached propriety. Nothing more, nothing less. Lou exhaled, but relief didn't come. She glanced at Tom, who stared at Devereaux.
Father, she whispered.
He shook his head and clasped her fingers.
Too much excitement for you, Lulu Bean.
He hadn't called her that in 5 years, since the revolution. Since he had entrusted her with special missions that not even Kari had known of, and tapped her nose with a smile.
You're my Lulu Bean. You can keep a secret so well it's as if you've taken a magic plant that sealed your lips. I trust you. You can do this.
All the blood in Lou's cheeks rushed for her heart.
Are you all right?
Tom nodded before she finished the question. Was her father unsettled because he shared an ancestry with Devereaux? She had been annoyed by it in the marketplace, too, that someone of Argridian descent would encourage prejudices that were so difficult for people like her father to overcome. When Lou faced the front again, she found Devereaux watching her. She glared back at him, and he started in response.
Our law states that crimes such as those committed by Devereaux Bell are punishable by death,
Laszlo declared.
I move for death by hanging. Is there a second?
Vex grinned. The girl was here. She wore the same nondescript gown from their encounter this morning, but she held herself differently. shoulders hard and chin level as if she one day intended to rule something. But Vex's nose still smarted where she'd hit him. And she'd laughed at his joke, then glared at him. Not an annoyed glare like the ones he'd received from Nyeli and Edda more times than he could count. One that said, in no uncertain terms, murder. She was getting more and more interesting by the second. One of the seniors, Laszlo, a guard, had said, was talking again.
Death by hanging. Is there a second?
Vex spun forward. What? Already?
Seconded!
A council member called from somewhere behind him. Another of the seniors leaned forward.
Are we certain that this is Devereaux Bell?
Vex sighed.
It's my hair, isn't it?
People always expect me to be blonde. The courtroom doors bounced off the walls and a different voice intervened.
It's him.
Vex shifted with the rest of the room to look at the new guest, Ingvar Pilkvist, head of the Raider Syndicate that called New Diza its home port. Pilkvist had the pale skin of those with Mecht ancestry, but if his hair had been Mecht blonde, that had been years ago. Wooden beads decorated the gray clumps that hung to his lower back, and he wore a vest of crocodile skin holding dozens of knives. But the rest of his image countered the usual undertakings of Stream Raider syndicates, stealing magic, selling the most dangerous plants, murdering whoever got in their way. Pilkvist's was the face that first drew people in, a caring grandfather who promised fairness and security. Pilkvist stopped at the front of the room. He'd brought three lackeys with him, all glowering at Vex. One had an odd-looking scarf of crocodile skin looped around his neck. Shit, not a scarf. An actual crocodile hatchling hissed on the raider's shoulder. Vex swallowed and forced himself to smile at Pilkvist.
Milkfist, it's been too long. When did we last see each other? A shipment of aerated blossoms was involved. I've been meaning to pay you back for it.
Pilkvist ignored him, but Vex caught a flush along his cheekbones.
I move that you turn Devereaux Bell over to me,
Pilkvist said.
The council is not in the business of giving prisoners to the raider syndicates, Head Pilkvist,
one of the seniors said.
The council isn't in the business of keeping its promises either.
Pilkvist heaved forward, and the council soldiers matched him. Pilkvist's raiders grasped their weapons.
Head Pilkvist,
another senior tried.
Please.
No,
Pilkvist said.
When you dragged my syndicate into Grace Loray's revolution, you promised we'd have a say in our government. 5 years, and all you've done is ignore our demands and steal our money. Stop pretending we're not separate.
One of the seniors, a man with a blotchy face, huffed.
We have stolen nothing from criminals.
The mainland trade. You take syndicate money with every boat of magic you sell.
A council-run trade assures that any funds from botanical magic benefit the people of Grace Loray, not just the individual syndicates,
countered the other senior, a woman who looked calmer than the blotchy man.
The magic trade should have been legal and government-controlled from the beginning of Grace Loray's founding. We have done nothing but restructure this island into a functioning...
Functioning. Sure. You call letting the syndicates fester into poverty functioning? What do you expect us to do now that the council controls the trade with the mainland? Least you can give me is rightful say over Devereaux Bell. He's a raider, and he's mine to deal with, Andrew.
Wait. Andrew, as in Kari Andrew? The infamous Kari the Wave, who'd come up with the guerrilla-style attacks that had chipped away at Argrid's more formal-style military during the revolution? Kari the Wave, who had personally planned more than a dozen of the rebels' moves against Argrid, taking storehouses, sinking ships, freeing people in missions, and hadn't lost any of the attacks she'd led? That, Andrew? This could be fun.
Go screw a smokestack, Silksist,
Vex cut in. Unlike Laszlo, Pilkfist didn't blubber. He backhanded Vex across the face.
Ow!
Head Pilkfist, said Andrew. You will not bring violence into our... this urchin.
Pilkfist cut her off, and when Vex righted himself, a fist met him in the gut.
Is an insult to every syndicate. He is a pest who must be eradicated.
Vex recovered from the second blow, and Pilkfist readied for a third.
And he is mine to eradicate.
Andrew appeared beside Pilkfist and grabbed his arm, her face red, her cream-colored skirt slapping Vex's boots. Behind her, soldiers moved in, weapons drawn. Pilkvist's raiders lurched forward a beat, and the crocodile around the one's neck clacked its jaw. Vex tasted blood. He had to focus on the pain to keep from smiling. It had been way too easy to turn the room upside down.
This is how you allow trials to operate,
came a voice from the front row of pews. Vex sought it out. A council member with slick black hair and a glossy overcoat, one of the Argridian diplomats. A completely unwelcome gush of terror made Vex croak. Andrew released Pilkfist.
I move we reconvene in 1 week, she said to the other seniors, to allow time for deliberation.
Relief spiraled through Vex. A week was better than nothing. He looked over the crowd, found the girl again, and winked at her. One of Pilkvist's raiders pulled out a pistol and clocked him on the base of his skull. Devereaux dropped to the tiles, his manacled hands keeping his body dangling from the post. Head Pilkfist gave a tight bow.
A pleasure doing business with you, Kari the Wave.
Kari's nostrils flared as though she wanted to say more, but she held back. The raiders left, trailed by the soft hissing of the small crocodile. Milo stood.
You allowed raiders to treat you with disrespect, and ones from the Mech Syndicate at that. They are barbarians. Have you any control over your country?
The courtroom drew a breath, and Lou thought that, if they could, everyone present would burrow into the tiled floor. Kari whirled on him.
You will not pretend to understand the operation of this island.
It was a rebuff that Argrid had misunderstood their colony when they had controlled it. Milo waved his hands.
We have accepted that Grace Loray holds to different standards of purity than we do, but surely your government has a registry of immigrants. Use that to begin restraining those who may have joined a syndicate and ensure that they cannot do harm to this government, or ours by extension once we finalize this peace treaty. If you...
Milo stopped, turning his head as he surveyed the slack-jawed council.
Oh,
he breathed.
You don't have a registry?
It would be better to invite the raider heads to a discussion and foster peace with them.
Kari said, but Milo didn't acknowledge her.
An addendum to our treaty.
He waved Laszlo to write, and Laszlo, dumbstruck, grabbed his pen.
Argrid demands Grace Loray eradicate stream raiders and the threat they pose to both our countries, first by condemning this Devereaux Bell outlaw to death.
Eradicate the stream raiders?
Kari echoed. Nausea visible on her face.
They are citizens of Grace Loray. They are numerous and well-armed, and as Pilkfist mentioned, they already resent the council for restructuring mainland trade. What you are suggesting will lead to civil war.
And what you have tolerated is mutiny. Without definitive action to prove that Grace Loray values order over crime, Argrid cannot, in good conscience, link itself to this island via a treaty.
That speared Lou in the chest. Laszlo called for a discussion on Bell's sentence and Milo's proposition. Council members shouted objections. Others cried agreement. Milo didn't move from where he stood in front of the seniors, as though each opinion needed to go through his ears first. Dread crept over Lou, darkening her vision. But she sucked in a breath and shook her head to clear it. Argrid had sought to cleanse the island and now demanded that Grace Lorraine continue their work. It didn't matter what Milo wanted or how they had gotten here. Lou might not have agreed with the syndicates, but they surely did not deserve to be eradicated. The council would negotiate a better resolution, and the Argridians would leave. There would be no need for rash action or, forbid it, civil war with the raiders. Lou was a lady now, a politician like her parents, fighting with her words and diplomacy. She would never again have to fight for Grace Lorraine in any other way.
5. The view from Eleazar's office had been breathtaking once. The cathedrals had stood tall, beacons for the lost, and the Inquisitor's University headquarters had gleamed. Shops had boasted lavish imports from neighboring countries, pungent spices from western Tunkay, polished gems and intricate weaponry from Grozda. Extravagant leather wardrobes brought across the northern valleys from Emmerdin, furs and wooden baubles from the distant, war-torn Mechtlans. Citizens had looked up at the palace, hands lifted in thanks to the pious god for blessing Argrid with a holy king who had brought them prosperity. Their fields and forests offered exports of cash crops and lumber. Their coast gave them abundant hauls of sea life and easy access to trade. Ben had been a child, but he had soaked up these lessons from proud monkses, excited to be part of such a prosperous, anointed country. But Argrid's military had never required many of their funds before. So when it became clear that the threat of burnings was not enough to keep the Grace Lorraine colonists in line, Eleazar had been forced to reallocate the funds from Argrid's exports. Buildings crumbled into disrepair. Shops were boarded up. Hunger and poverty struck the outlying villages and flooded Deza's poorer districts. Twists of smoke rose where infected belongings had been burned to prevent the spread of disease. As Ben stood at the window the afternoon following his Inquisitor patrol, he watched passing citizens lift cupped hands in reverence to the Holy Eminence King who guided them through this struggle. His breath streaked across the glass. Sometimes he envied Grace Lorraine's democracy. Better to have a country of people who participated in their ruling rather than people who took everything from their king as truth. Such unwavering belief, however, was the reason Argrid had never needed a strong military before the revolution. The threat of hell was enough to thwart any dissent. The door to Eleazar's office opened and shut. Ben's awareness peaked, but he didn't turn. A chair slid out.
You disappoint me, Benyet.
Ben faced his father.
Eleazar sat at a desk with bookshelves behind him, displaying church tomes and statues of the Graces. Grace Araceli, for the pious god's pillar of penance. Grace Lorraine, for the pillar of purity and the evangelist who, centuries ago, began the mission to purify what became his namesake island. And more. The oddments gave Eleazar consequence, even when he wore a silk shirt, cravat, and breeches instead of his ceremonial robes. Though Ben couldn't remember his father ever being anything less than imposing. His black hair had just given way to gray, and his smooth brown skin merely looked more lived in than Ben's finer features. Years of bearing the title name of Eleazar, of balancing the politics of kingship with the religious guidance of eminence, fending off evil and uprisings, none of that had worn on Ben's father. Everything he'd done at the bidding of the pious god. There was no better reason. No safer excuse.
How so?
Ben put the desk between them, hands behind his back. Poor Prince Benyet, people would say once they heard that his father had, yet again, summoned him to berate him. And after an Inquisitor patrol, no less. Eleazar lifted a dark eyebrow.
You showed up at your patrol, hungover. You allowed the condemned to speak, which is the reason they felt free to attack you. Things could have ended in disaster had your defensors not been able to restrain the raider. With all due respect,